You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. As the world evaluates the pandemic response and debates on decolonizing global health gain momentum, equity in global health has never been more urgent. In this episode of PX Pulse, we'll be talking about why and how the decisions that shape global health must be made by those facing the greatest risks. Later in the conversation, we'll hear from Dr. Madhu Pai, a leader in global health and one of its most vocal critics. But first, two members of the Coalition to Build Momentum, Power, Activism, Strategy, and Solidarity, or Compass Africa, are joining us for a close look at how this transnational civil society coalition is pioneering a new approach to leadership that decentralizes power. Launched in 2017, the Compass Coalition supports more than two dozen member organizations in Malawi, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe to undertake high-impact campaigns in their countries to advance HIV prevention. From the very start, Compass planned to transition leadership from AVAC, a U.S.-based organization who served as the secretariat and primary grant holder in the initial phases, to organizations based where the work actually happens. In January, Compass took this step. Tanzania's Francis Luole and Zimbabwe's Barbara Nwebe helped navigate the coalition through this two-year process, which has resulted in Pangea Zimbabwe becoming the new secretariat, and they hold the primary grant relationship with donors. Compass members also developed a new participatory approach to the governance of the coalition itself. This involved strengthening guidance on operations and coming up with an approach to leadership based on power sharing, a goal that Compass envisioned at its founding. So, Barbs and Francis, Compass has had a lot of success in its campaigns. I'm going to just highlight a few of them, and then let's get into the conversation. In its initial years, Compass campaigns have fought for community-led monitoring of essential programs. This ensures that the programs are effective. They've changed consent laws to make it easier for people to get HIV services. Other campaigns have secured money for programs designed to reach stigmatized populations. This is a lot of success under the old structure. So tell me, why a change to this new structure with Pangea Zimbabwe at the helm with the secretariat and a new governance manual? Why was it needed? And Barbs, let me start with you.
I think the intention is very clear, even in the name, Compass Africa. So it's the coalition to build momentum, power, activism, strategy, and solidarity in Africa. So even from the onset, the plan was African civil society coalitions take a lead in the advocacy to strengthen the HIV response within Africa. And the transnational coalition in its formulation was intentional. The Global North partners were able to share tactics, we're able to share strategies, we're able to elevate the advocacy campaigns. So in many ways, they brought in an aspect of technical support that we may not have had as African partners at the time. And they built capacities in different ways, such as understanding data, how to engage at global platforms, how to escalate advocacy tactics, what does a win look like, how to push business unusual agendas, such that African partners, African activists, and advocates could stand in spaces and truly understand and interpret their own context and their own data. And over time, that transference of knowledge was supposed to empower the African civil society coalitions to run this race.
We really needed AVAC's leadership to put all this together in collaboration with other partners. But eventually, after putting everything in order, the change was necessary. We have quite a number of African-led organizations with the required capacity to take over. And the other key reason that aligns with the big vision of Compass Africa is to lead by example. Part of our focus areas is pushing for community leadership in the HIV response and generally the colonization of global health. Therefore, we had to demonstrate that within the structure of our coalition, because mainly the advocacy works of our coalition are carried out in Africa. Hence, for sustainability, having an African-led organization leading the initiative means a lot.
Very clear. I'm especially picking up on the transfer of knowledge piece and also a deep desire to model the demands that you're making in your campaigns for investment in community leadership. Show how it's done. Compass members undertook a careful multi-year process to prepare for this transition. Why was that? You know, what did that involve and why did it need all this time?
It was definitely necessary to take time because this was a co-creation. And as you might imagine, co-creating something requires everyone's voice, requires everyone's input, requires inclusivity, requires a chance for everybody to be at the table. And that in itself requires very intentional processes that allow people to think about how do we want to work together as a coalition. We had to take time to think through all of that. And because it required so many people at the table, it meant that we had to break away into small working groups, really think through this over time systematically. And I think we did well to take time because there's a strong sense of buy-in within the coalition around this transition that we're in right now. It's something that we're all ready for, and it's something that we're all prepared to contribute to. And we really look forward to demonstrating that this actually works, that when you talk about decolonizing global health, it's not just talk and talk that is cheap. Because I know at some point people have been asking, did AVAC really, really decide to hand this over? It almost feels like, is it really possible? And here we are saying it is possible because even in that time, AVAC took a very leading role in supporting partners in that transition, in that decision-making, in the sense that when it was time to determine who would take on the leadership in the next phase, they were able to hold hands with Pangea, for instance, at that point, and work with them intentionally, providing guidance as to how they've done things previously. Just having that support and just having that sincerity was everything. So time was essential, and time remains essential even as you watch this coalition unfold in this new era.
I'm hearing a couple of key components here. One, get buy-in from everybody. Two, set a very clear intention about that inclusivity. Another key point that as AVAC was relinquishing one kind of leadership, they were showing another kind of leadership in how to support, you called it, hold hands with Pangea when needed, as in, you know, we're here if you need support, but you're in charge. And these are the values I'm hearing that guided Compass through this process. Also, Francis, you mentioned the governance manual, this critical tool for building out the transition, and noting that it's going to continue to evolve. Can you tell me what was the hardest part of this process? Where was it difficult to find consensus or trust, the pinch points in as you went along, and what you're watching as you put all this into action?
In my opinion, making a decision which African-led organization would take over after AVAC was not easy, especially as we have grown to have quite a number of qualified African-led organizations within the coalition. This decision was jointly made by all partners through a survey conducted by an independent consultant that showed that more than 70% of Compass Africa partners were in agreement with having Pangea Zimbabwe to take over after AVAC. However, in our governance manual, it is clearly articulated that all other African-led organizations have an equal chance to also take over the leadership role in the future, and the existing secretariat or the grant holder will be assessed after every 3 years, and changes may be made whenever deemed necessary.
So taking the time with the transition was a tactic, so to speak, for success, and it gave the coalition members an opportunity to identify concerns and talk it through and be reassured. In your greatest hopes, what do you think it'll mean for the campaigns?
I strongly believe that Africa have the strongest passion of coming up with innovative and sustainable solutions and willingness to take necessary actions accordingly. Hence, other need to support other than undermining this passion and contextual understanding. You know, in Swahili, we have this proverb which says, "Aliyevaa kiatu ndiye anajua wapi kinambana," which translates to the one wearing the shoes knows where it pinches. It emphasizes the idea that only the community directly experiencing a situation truly understands its challenges and what needs to be done to address that. It is, therefore, significant to have Africa lead the world in making critical decisions, like highlighting what are actual key priorities in HIV response and other related pandemics. We need to be entrusted by the world to influence how resources are channeled and come up with tangible solutions.
So this is definitely going to show that things are going to evolve and become better, hopefully. The good news about this is Campus Africa remains a transnational coalition. I think what we really need to put out there is that the roles have just shifted. So it's not like we don't need Global North partners anymore. We remain Campus Africa because from the onset, we're born together and we're building this out together. The role has changed. And I think it's time to really demonstrate that African-centered activism, African-centered advocacy actually works and can produce results in real time and results that address the problems on the ground in that moment.
And when it comes to this leadership structure serving as a model, potentially, what are your aspirations around that? I'm especially thinking about some of the provisions in the governance manual you mentioned earlier that empower members, a lot of structure to keep the governance accountable to the members.
The structure of the model we have is among of the best governance structures that can set a good example to other similar advocacy coalitions and organizations in Africa. That means Compass Africa, we've also paved a way for African-led coalitions and organizations, because most of the partners before thought that there was no way they can be entrusted by donors like Bill and Melinda Gates to lead initiatives like this of Compass Africa. I can say that this was an important step we've taken to remind African-led organizations we are working with and the ones within the coalition of their leadership power and influence they have in the global health space. And I urge African-led organizations to understand their position in the global health and claim it by acting accordingly. And also other organizations based in US, Europe, and across the globe to have this understanding by entrusting on the capacity of African-led organizations. Donors need to support these organizations. It's possible to put Africans in the front. And it does not mean that we no longer need the support from other countries or they're not important. No, it's a joint work, but we need to put the most affected in the front while others support where necessary.
Letting communities lead means we fund communities. Letting communities lead means we trust them. I think letting communities lead is trusting that there is expertise even in Africa and believing that that expertise will deliver strong health outcomes, not just for HIV. So I think if you're a funder, an activist, an advocate, it's time that we are truly sincere about letting communities lead.
Compass Africa is providing a much-needed model that should be closely watched. Can these efforts be the start of a sea change in global health where transparent governance with power in the hands of communities is the norm, not the exception? Dr. Madhu Pai joined us to widen this question with a kind of status report on equity in global health. Dr. Pai is a Canada Research Chair of Epidemiology and Global Health at McGill University and co-editor-in-chief of PLOS Global Health. He's also a frequent contributor in the media on equity in global health with bylines in The Lancet, HuffPost, Stat, DevEx, Scientific America, and others. He has been a vocal critic of the vast machinery for delivering healthcare, from research to rollout, for its control by rich countries, and for its failures. Dr. Pai, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let me roll out a few statistics to kind of help us understand what inequity in global health means. $35 billion invested in medical research in 2022, but less than $4 billion was spent on major global killers like TB or malaria. And these are diseases that hit people primarily in the global south. CEOs and board chairs among the 372 leading global health organizations are 66% men, 77% from rich countries, 83% with degrees from rich countries. COVID vaccine disparities are just heart-crushing reminders of these extremes. In 2022, barely 15% of the population in poor countries had received a single dose, but multiple doses per person were available in rich countries. Dr. Pai, what do you track to understand the trend, the direction, and whether it's getting better or worse in global health?
Well, I think the biggest worrisome inequity, the mother of all inequities, as I call it, is the economic inequities. Every year around Davos, Oxfam puts out their global state of inequity report. And every year, things are getting worse and worse and worse. A handful of rich men own as much wealth as 50% of the world's population of 8 billion. And even as millions have become poorer during the pandemic, they have pretty much doubled their wealth. And that extraordinary amount of wealth concentration results in dramatic shifts in who gets a say in global health, who sets the agenda, whether it's Davos or whether it's donors, and how far they are from having lived experience and how far they are from where the real genuine problems are. And this in turn translates to where global health organizations are headquartered, typically in the US or Europe. Who sits on these boards? Just mostly people from Global North. And most of the organizations are run by men from the Global North. And needless to say, much of the money that is given out as global health donor monies or aid money or grants primarily go to organizations within these wealthy countries. So much of USAID money goes to American contractors, much of UK Wellcome Trust money goes to British groups, so on and so forth, then percolates all the way across the chain in terms of who gets to publish, who wins awards, who gets to speak at conferences, who gets to be an editor. So this is why when we say global health is neither global nor diverse, this is exactly the data that underlie that statement.
And what are the health outcomes of this concentration of wealth and power? What does it mean for people in their daily lives?
Well, the fact that in a one in a century catastrophic global pandemic, we completely abandoned millions of people who couldn't even get a single shot of COVID vaccine, to me, is the ultimate reflection of how skewed this world is and who holds the power. The richest nations in the world, including mine, Canada, and we have published about this, hoarded vaccines when it was needed the most. Too little, too late was done to provide vaccines to low and middle income countries. And we did not even back the request from 100 plus countries to waive the intellectual property so that they could manufacture their own vaccines and save themselves. And the fact that even this year, this very minute, that as a pandemic accord is being negotiated, there is a widespread gloom in the global health world that the pandemic accord is not going to be worth much because all of the required equity clauses, mandatory sharing clauses, everything that we've learned from how messed up the first pandemic response was, have all but been diluted and edited out by the richest global North countries. Lancet just put out a commentary on their cover page that a handful of rich nations are pretty much sabotaging this entire pandemic accord and the equity that is supposed to be a part of it. So the fact that even after 3-4 years of the pandemic, even after the egregious mistakes that we made, the fact that the rich nations are essentially able to veto everybody else on critical things like access to life-saving medicines is to me the strongest indication that I do not expect anything to be different in the next pandemic. Hoarding, not sharing, basically bullying techniques, and the big pharma running all over. I mean, they are in complete collusion with the leaders of global North countries, which is why they are editing out all equity clauses. And this isn't just speculation. This is actual data based on the lobbying efforts by big pharma. So I'm terrified if there was another pandemic, whether we'll do anything different than the disastrous response this time around in terms of inequities.
Mm. You mentioned Big Pharma and the role of the U.S. government, and I'm also thinking about all the many institutions that lead global health, and many of them in the last few years started to talk about greater equity and even decolonizing global health. There's a lot of statements, there's a lot of committees, there's been some more diverse hiring. Is there a possibility here? Has there been a moment when you thought these actions could lead to more?
I must say, for a while, I felt hopeful because in around middle of 2020, as you know, after the murder of George Floyd, you know, every organization put up pledges on equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism, and all sorts of nice statements came out from everyone. There was some effort to do DEI or diversity hiring and stuff like that. Then there was a Me Too movement and Women in Global Health movement, Decolonizing Global Health. All of these movements were kind of coming together in some ways, all kind of learning from each other or feeding each other. But in 2024, we can pretty much see that even performative DEI, which is not even serious to begin with, is already being dismantled in many, many parts of the world, United States in particular. And I'm not even sure if anybody is serious about anything that they said after George Floyd's murder. So from that perspective, it does look extremely difficult. For a while, there was some hope. I'm not sure anymore. I think sharing power or giving up power is not something that comes naturally to anybody with power. As the famous saying goes, power does not seek power. I think there has to be a demand from those who have been denied power and equity to take control of their own agenda, to self-determine their own destiny, and to be self-sufficient. That, I think, is one of the strongest rays of hope. For example, when Africa CDC says, we need to make our own vaccines on our continent, right, on our soil, medicines, that to me is what I really look for. That is where I get my inspiration from. Or when India shares vaccines with, rest of Asia, wherever, South-South solidarity, right, support from within the South, the way South Africa stood up to support Palestine, right? These are all real examples where South-South solidarity and a much stronger, determined global South is what's necessary. Because I don't honestly expect global North to wake up one morning and give up their power. That is never going to happen. It has never happened in the past. There is no recognized time in history when that has happened, where the power have ceded power willingly. And so we should not expect that to happen, to be honest. So decolonizing global health is impossible from that perspective. I certainly don't see it after everything I've seen during the pandemic. The pandemic was the wake-up call, the ultimate opportunity to do something different, and the global north failed miserably. So if that didn't change anything, it's all nice to say, you know, they need to give up or share power, but it is simply will not come to them naturally. They have to be forced to do it.
Understood. Let's drill down to smaller scale actors where there are North-South collaborations and some of them trying to pioneer new ways of doing something, such as Compass Africa. What's the potential for innovation at this level?
Yes. So when I give these sorts of talks, I always try and include some positive examples, right? Because I myself am looking for hope and inspiration, right? So for me, one positive hope would be if and when the Africa region starts manufacturing their own vaccines and medicines, I would be celebrating this as an immensely important step in the right direction. Global health funders, for example, some of them are explicitly talking about moving more money to the global South actors or communities that are directly impacted. And, you know, whether they call it localization or whether they call it something else, if they can shift more of the grants and grant making directly to affected communities and partners in the global South, that would be incredible. And I think there is some hope on that front. There are organizations, and then here I use the IPAS an example. IPAS is an international NGO that works on reproductive and sexual health. And IPAS is moving away from a US-centered, power-centered model to sharing power to their country offices and essentially decentering from their global north. I think decentering from the global north is the right model for global health. And I was delighted to hear about Compass that AVAC and others are working on to move your secretariat to Zimbabwe. I think this is the right model. Divest, decenter, and basically share power.
Let's talk more about that. Divest, decenter as a model for North-South collaboration. How do you do it right?
So a genuine decentering means not headquarters in New York or not headquarters in London or hiring one Black person or one brown person. No matter how nice it looks on paper, that is not genuine decentering of power, right? Decentering of power means we have to be able to say they don't need to come to us for every damn thing to be approved. If it is, then you genuinely have not decentered anything. If everything has to be signed off in Boston or Seattle, I'm sorry, that is not decentering. And it's not even to be called that. So I think that's important. Secondly, and this is an experience that we have learned over 2 years of hard work in the journal that I'm co-editor-in-chief of, Boss Global Public Health, we need to ensure diversity right at the leadership level, because you can diversify all you want at the lower levels of the organizations. But in the end, who signs off is the person sitting in the global north, which could well be a white man. So we made sure there's diversity at the leadership level, and then we made sure more than 70% of our section editors are women, 50% on the global south. And among the 600, 700 editors that we have, half are based in the global south. That is hard, intentional 2 years worth of work to get there. And we do it on a daily basis. In other words, every time we even commission an article, we're asking, are we platforming the same people in the global north again and again and again, right? Are we really inviting people from the community, those who would normally never make it to a journal, never get invited to speak, but they are the ones who have lived experience? How do you reverse the trend of platforming ourselves, Global North folks, and our ideas and our organizations, to platforming Global South, Indigenous organizations, communities that are most impacted? And that I have learned after 2 years of hard work, I promise you, it is extraordinary level of effort if you want to follow that path. It is not one that I would recommend to anyone to do lightly. So in other words, it's easy to say DEI and whatnot. Walking that path is brutally difficult. And that is why most organizations say all the right things, but do nothing in the end, because they don't have the courage to follow up on what they're saying. And courage takes a lot of risk and time and effort.
So what's the key to success in this? If it takes great effort, great commitment, what sustains you? And what do you turn to, principles or tools that make it possible to succeed?
So it's that you got to kind of start with great clarity on what you intend to achieve. For example, if you say 50% of the grants given by us will go directly to Global South communities, if that's an intent, you just work very hard to make that happen. Everything that you say, you got to have the courage to follow up on. Otherwise, there's no point in making blanket statements. The best practices would be a written statement of your intent right at the start. In other words, if you're fuzzy in your original opening statement, then there's no way for anyone to hold you accountable. I can't say, for example, oh, our granting agency will try hard to be inclusive. What the hell does that mean? It means nothing. Instead, if you say, we are putting out these metrics that we will be judging ourselves, and you can hold us accountable on the basis of those metrics. So if you say 50% of our grants will go directly to further impacted communities in the global south by the year 2025, ask me at the end, I should be able to give you that proportion. Is it 43? Is it 21? Is it 19? Is it zero? Whatever it is, I should be able to tell you. I should be able to show you my budget. Somebody said this beautifully. DEI means nothing if there's no budgetary change to back that DEI. If much of your money is going to Global North partners or to communities in privileged places, then that budget will show. It will not lie, right? Budgets don't lie. So if somebody asks me what proportion of your editors are in the Global South, I should be able to tell them. If somebody said what proportion of your authors are in the Global South, I should be able to tell them. Measuring and repeatedly measuring. So it's not a one-time deal. This is like a lifelong deal. whoever is in my role, I may not be an editor-in-chief tomorrow, whoever takes over from me, they will have to carry this intentionality and this ability to track what is going on. The minute you stop working at it, it tends to revert back to everything we've done in the past. Again, it'll end up in Boston, Seattle, London. Again, it'll end up with people with privilege. Again, you will see a complete skewness in how all the numbers will fall apart. So you got to keep on at it, and it never stops because there's no end point or an end date to allyship. If you want to be good allies, you got to be in it for life.
And what do we stand to gain?
If we care about ending AIDS, then we need to platform communities that are being decimated by this infectious disease. If we care about ending TB, power needs to rest with countries with the highest burden of TB. This is the only way we will finally achieve what we claim to be fighting for. We often say we want to end HIV, we say we want to end inequities, and yet we don't understand that us holding on to power is doing the opposite. It is perpetuating inequities. So if we even care about achieving our own set goals, then it is in our interest to step back and share power and be allies rather than the ones running everything.
The members of Compass Africa and Dr. Pai are part of a small but growing movement to do the painstaking job of making power sharing work. These are vital, necessary experiments to break free from the old ways of doing business that have left most of the world stranded, while only the privileged few enjoy the benefits of science. This work needs champions. It needs your support. To learn more about the Compass model for decolonizing global health, watch out for our blog titled South-Based Leadership in Global Health, a journey of success, growth, and change for the Compass Coalition. And find additional resources by going to pxpulse@avac.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Jean Barron. You've been listening to PX Pulse, recorded in the New York City studios of the Relic Room. Our theme music was composed by Alexi Stevens. Our engineer is Sam Baer. I'm Jean Barron.